Welcome to episode 11 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my guest for today is Corey Attad, a Toronto-based writer who has written for Esquire, Hazlitt, and The Baffler, among other outlets. We bonded on Twitter because of the Bane jokes that we were both making when The Dark Knight Rises was a fresh movie. It's hard to believe that we've been making Bane jokes for 8 years, but that's an indicator of just how funny Bane is. And one reason why we're going to be talking about Bane today is because I've had a bit of a change of heart in the last few weeks about Christopher Nolan. Corey has more affection for Nolan than I do, and I thought it would be very fun for us to talk about Bane as a stepping off point for an overall discussion of how Nolan is good now. Corey, welcome to Junk Filter.
Speak of the devil and he shall appear.
I had to do it.
Oh, victory has defeated you.
We're going to be doing Bane jokes for the entire episode.
I mean, we need to, like, hold off on them because we could just do them back and forth for the next, like, 2 hours, just that. And I think it would be entertaining enough, but, you know, we don't want to annoy everyone too much.
Corey, my first question is, did they make a decision to make Bane the bad guy in the third of the Nolan Batman trilogy because of the death of Heath Ledger? Were they planning on having the Joker back, or were they always planning to have Bane as the villain? That's one thing I don't quite know.
I actually don't know. I mean, I think some people have theories that there was an intention to bring Ledger back, but the truth is he died like before they even finished post on that movie. So I don't know that they were quite thinking of what they were going to do next. So, you know, it's possible if he was alive, he would have come back, but I can't imagine that Nolan would have, even if he had brought him back, would have wanted to make him the main villain, because that was the second movie. Why would you repeat yourself, right? And instead we got Bane. So, you know, I'm not complaining.
Our first glimpse of Bane was in 2011. I went to see the IMAX teaser that was attached to Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. And I found it very funny because it was basically the first 3 or 4 minutes of The Dark Knight Rises, the prologue, with Bane being taken on an airplane and subduing the crew and the plane being kidnapped by an even bigger plane. But what was so funny about that trailer, as incredible as the visuals were, was that you couldn't make out a fucking word that Bane was saying.
It's one of the classic. I remember when. Go ahead.
No one knew who I was until I put on the mask.
But we're in like this gigantic IMAX theater, and it's like,
okay.
It's one of those classic moments. I remember when I saw that, because I saw that as well at the Scotiabank Theater, and I just remember being like, this has got to be some kind of mistake with how they've done the volume in the theater, or maybe it's because the mix isn't finished yet, or there's something wrong here. And then it turned out the mix was not finished, but only because I guess they realized that it was so indecipherable, they had to redub his lines.
I read, though, that Nolan's original plan was to have Bane sound like that for the entire movie, and that it was sort of a concession to the studio to re-record it so that you could make it out.
Yeah, I mean, it's... that wouldn't surprise me in the least, given some of his track record since. But that was definitely like the beginning point of Nolan and his very suspect dialogue mixes, which I think came, we can get into this a bit later, but I think in this movie and with Bane, it's actually quite important, is that Nolan likes to record dialogue on set. He doesn't really like to do ADR if he can help it. But when you're shooting somebody who's talking through a mask on a plane, you're going to run into issues. And I think that, you know, the re-recording, I assume that they re-recorded much of his dialogue throughout the movie, and it lends the audio mix this really interesting quality whenever he speaks, where it sounds like he's coming from all the speakers. It's kind of great, actually. It's sort of enveloping, especially the scene we'll talk about later, but where he and Batman have their first fight. It's quite eerie. It's really fun.
I remember being amused when I watched The Dark Knight Rises that many of Bane's entrances in a few scenes is off screen. You just hear him say,
"Speak of the devil and he shall appear."
And then you see that Bane's there.
Yeah.
Like he keeps getting introduced off screen.
Well,
with that voice.
Yeah, I mean,
which sounds a little like Sean Connery.
Yes, it's like Sean. It's like a parody of Sean Connery. I mean, the movie. I don't know. It's a very fine line with this movie, because I think there is sort of a humor to the movie. And I think that there's an understanding, Nolan does have an understanding of like some of the camp element of doing a superhero movie. And my proof of that is always, I think of the opening scene of The Dark Knight with the heist and these, you know, Joker's goons who all sound like, just like they're doing a parody of a New York accent. And, you know, so there's got to be some level of self-awareness, but you can never quite tell where the line is. And so I don't know if he intends Bane to be funny, but he definitely is very, very funny. He's incredibly fun and funny villain and, you know, imposing, but just hilarious.
When I watched the first two of the Nolan Batman movies, Batman Begins was fine. The Dark Knight was fine. I didn't love either of them, but I had a really good time with The Dark Knight Rises. And one reason why is because there was such a lack of humor in the first two films. Mm-hmm. That The Dark Knight Rises paid off for me because I found it very funny.
Yes.
In a kind of combination of being deliberately funny and accidentally funny.
Yeah, I mean, in that way, I guess we can talk a little bit about where we come from on these movies. Like, you know, I like Nolan generally. You know, we've talked about this off air, but I think I first saw Memento when I would have been like 14 or 15. And it was the kind of thing that's like mind blowing, right? They told a story backwards. How can they do that? That's amazing. And then, of course, I saw Irreversible later and I was like, well, you can also do it that way to a very different effect. I remember when I saw Batman Begins, I was not very into it. I'm still not like it's fine. I enjoy it, but it's, you know, it's not my favorite. It's like you said, it's kind of humorless, but it's got some good stuff in it. And then The Dark Knight, I really, really like. But again, it's, you know, other than a few like one-liners or whatever, it's humorless. And it's very like, oh, we're going to wrestle with like the consequences of these things. And we're going to deal with like the fascism of the American military state and kind of endorse it, but kind of not. And, you know, and it's a heavy movie. And that one also has the issue of like sort of the metatextual element of Ledger having passed away. And so there's a bit of a cloud over it. Like this is something important that you're watching, this great performance by this great actor who didn't get to do too much more after that, unfortunately. But then, like, Dark Knight Rises, on the one hand, is weighted down with all the expectations of the previous movie, and yet, to me, feels completely free of any obligation to match it. And it makes it so much more just moment-to-moment entertaining. It's the one of the trilogy that I'll just put on just to have a good time. A lot of that is to do with Bane. I mean, it's like right from the opening scene, when you've got Mayor Carcetti, welcoming, Bane into this plane and pulling his hood off. And just that whole sequence is so absurd. In fact, this time I was trying to understand why Bane is even there, because it seems like he's being delivered by some mercenaries who are not on the side of Mayor Carcetti from The Wire, but yet Carcetti is still in charge of the plane. I'm very confused about it. Doesn't really matter because Bane is so great.
Let me tell you that the Dark Knight Rises came out in 2012. I thought that scene was very funny because the actor reminded me a lot of Rick Santorum. So yes. For me, it was like Rick Santorum was trying to kidnap Bane.
And I think it would go similarly badly if he did that.
And just to say quickly that, Rick Santorum would have been definitely killed by Bane. But the other thing was that there were some right-wingers who were a little bit upset about The Dark Knight Rises because of the name of the bad guy. Mitt Romney's notorious company that he worked for was Bain Capital.
I remember that. They thought it was a shot at him.
Some people were thinking that there was some kind of shot at the Republicans and at Mitt Romney for naming the character Bane, even though Bane is a Batman villain that goes back to the 90s.
Yeah, definitely predates the public knowledge of Bain Capital.
But speaking of the Republicans, there were also a lot of conservatives who were entertained by The Dark Knight Rises because they detected it to have conservative politics. Mm-hmm. The way that, I mean, I know we're getting ahead of ourselves, but the Bane character uses a lot of leftist revolutionary language when he's taking over Gotham City, which is intentionally a ruse to trick the people by getting them to be on his side, when in fact it's all part of his master plan to create chaos and destruction. The idea that the left are a bunch of saps who would take a guy like Bane to be a true hero when he's actually evil.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about this now. I mean, there's the sequence where he's sort of taken over the city at this point, and he gives his big speech in front of whatever, the Gotham Penitentiary. And, you know, he has that line about, you know, we give it back to you, the people, which ended up almost word for word in Trump's inauguration, which I'm convinced Stephen Miller had to have written that inauguration speech, 100% did that on purpose, and 100% thought that, like, Bane was saying cool shit, which, like, you know, maybe in some contexts, but not in the context of that movie. I mean, one of the funniest bits in that speech to me is that he's talking about, like, you know, giving the city back to the underclass and all of that. And he says that they should, he goes, start by storming Blackgate and freeing the oppressed. And the next shot is like a bunch of hardened criminals all carrying like automatic weapons rushing out of the prison. And of course, not only that, he's telling the public to storm the prison, but he's actually the one who blows up the door to the prison. So it's nothing to do with the public. It's such an absurd situation. I don't know what Nolan's personal politics are. I don't detect in him much in the way of like political thinking in his films. I think that he's sort of latching onto zeitgeisty type things. So, you know, at the time, it's interesting, the movie was shot while Occupy was going on. The script had already been written, so a lot of this stuff was already in motion. But, you know, it's post-economic crisis and all of that. And I think that he just is like, oh, okay, there's something in the air about, you know, rich people and rich people being the villain, especially in the context of a film that's about, like, well, we've locked up all the criminals, so who's left? Oh, well, it turns out that rich people are the criminals because they're corrupt or, you know, whatever. I do see some people sometimes going like, oh, well, he's clearly a conservative or whatever. I don't know if that's the case. But, you know, these are superhero movies. Batman, I don't know what to tell people. That he's a fascist. Like, it's sort of unavoidable. There's not really a good way to deal with that. And I find superhero movies that try to paper over that to me feel very disingenuous. But all of that is to say, it's interesting to me that conservatives would see the villain of this movie and be like, well, this is our inspiration. This is like speaking to us.
And this is one of the most important things about Bane. Like, when I think back to movies made in the last, I don't know, we could take it all the way back to the beginning of this century. To have a good villain in a movie, they have to have memorable lines of dialogue.
Yes.
And one thing about Bane that I love, like, can you name a movie villain in the last 20 years or so with this many memorable lines of dialogue? The first scene in the airplane, Bane says about 8 or 9 classic lines of dialogue.
Yeah. It's incredible.
Perhaps they're wondering why you'd shoot a man before throwing him out of a plane. It's so
great.
It doesn't matter who we are. What matters is our plan.
It's just so, and the voice is so funny, and the lines of dialogue are so funny. So I was hooked immediately.
Nolan and I guess his brother, and I think there was another writer on those movies, they clearly have an understanding of how to create, like, sort of good villain dialogue. But with Bane, it seemed like they decided that everything that comes out of his mouth should be something that's incredibly memorable. And often it comes from, like, somebody says something perfectly normal to him, and he responds in just the most absurd way. You know,
do you feel in charge?
It's like, what are you? I'm Gotham's Reckoning. Like, what is that? I don't even... It's so crazy.
Giving Bane so many incredible lines of dialogue and casting the incredibly handsome Tom Hardy as Bane, and then putting a mask over his face and getting him to say all these lines like Sean Connery. What was dawning on me with The Dark Knight Rises was that they had figured out how to synthesize the sort of camp elements of Batman that we're familiar with the serious-minded Nolan filmmaking where it looks like Michael Mann directed a Batman movie.
Yeah, totally.
But there's a perverse joke going on that the main villain is you can't see him, you can't see his mouth move, you can barely make out what he's saying, and he's saying it in a funny voice.
I don't know how they came up with it. I assume that it was some bender that Tom Hardy went on and he decided he loves doing accents. And he was just like, Chris, I'm going to do this. It's going to sound like Sean Connery, you know, making a joke out of Sean Connery. And Nolan was just like, sounds great. Let's do it. Like, it's the fact that no studio exec came to him and was like, I think maybe we need to try something else.
This is where we're heading in this conversation, is that Nolan is in this very interesting position as a filmmaker now, where he has creative control, he has gigantic budgets, but there's this experimental streak that is also being allowed to exist by Warner Brothers. Like, most filmmakers wouldn't have been that perverse about making the bad guy indecipherable.
Yeah.
But Nolan gets away with it.
This is part of what, you know, we've been dealing with sort of the Tenet conversation and the way that it was released. But there was a lot of money riding on these movies, and yet he's maybe the only person who's able to make movies at that budget, at that level, and just sort of given the go-ahead to just go for it. I mean, even like Scorsese will, you know, get Netflix to pay like $150 or $200 million for The Irishman, but that almost feels like he conned them into it. Whereas Nolan, actually, it's like based on some kind of a track record that they're just like, we trust you. That's a really unique position these days for a filmmaker to be in. And he seems to really take advantage of it.
I've never really been a huge fan of Nolan's work. Maybe it's because I'm a little bit older and, you know, when I saw the sort of formal experiments that he was doing, I found them to never really get off the ground. Like, I found them clever, but I didn't find them particularly involving. Like, I wasn't particularly moved by anything that I had seen in his films, though I was aware of his craftsmanship.
Right.
I was left cold.
Right.
So in a way, I went into The Dark Knight Rises out of more of a sense of an obligation that I've seen the other two. I better see how this whole thing ends. And was disarmed by it. I was increasingly happy watching the movie. I had a smile on my face a lot of the time. I thought that Nolan had addressed some of the quibbles that I have about, for instance, his inability to like stage fight scenes. Mm-hmm. Like, all that stuff is fading away for me now, and I'm starting to appreciate him more as I'm thinking that the formal experimentation has almost gotten a little bit more perverse as his budgets have increased, and I am fully in favor of that.
Yeah,
I would like to see more filmmakers doing that kind of stuff with the money.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is, I just don't think, and I don't think any other filmmaker gets that money and are in a position to do something like that, because when they get that money, they're making a Marvel movie or they're making, you know, Jurassic World 2. It's really hard to kind of compare him. And look, even I have had my issues with him in terms of the budgets. Like, my favorite movie of his, which I know you haven't seen, is The Prestige, which is sort of a mid-budget movie. Doesn't have like action sequences or anything. And to me, that's like just his sort of perfect movie. It's where everything kind of came together in just the right way so that it's emotional and intellectually stimulating, and it's, you know, it looks great as well. It's got great performances. But I think that there's also something interesting with that movie and Batman Begins right before it, which kind of comes from his original experiments, particularly in Memento, with using time in movies. So in Memento, he's sort of telling this story in reverse chronological order. But it's been a few years since I've seen Memento, but the last time I watched it, for as sort of intelligently crafted as I think it is, and clever, there's something about the way that it's edited where it's sort of reverse chronological, but then it has these sort of, it stops to then have this sort of exposition kind of sequence in black and white, and then it goes back and it keeps doing that, and it sort of slows the momentum of the movie. Whereas in Batman Begins, Insomnia was sort of, you know, he's remaking whatever. And then Batman Begins, he seemed to latch onto an idea where that one also has some flashbacks and stuff, but more importantly, something about the way that he's using music and the way that he's editing the film so that it's almost like it's a trailer for itself, where it just has a constant forward momentum. And The Prestige is even more kind of intense that way, where it's just constantly moving. And it has like, that's a movie that has like flashbacks within flashbacks within flashbacks, people sort of reading each other's diaries and things like that. And yet, it's never confusing. And also it's constantly propulsive. He takes that to the next level in The Dark Knight. It progresses even more in Inception, where you're dealing with like dreams within dreams. It happens in The Dark Knight Rises, where is it 3 hours? It's like
just
2 hours 40 or
just
something.
Just under.
Yeah. And it moves at a really nice pace. It's just moving. And then you get to there's Interstellar, which follows a similar mold, but where it really takes things to the next level is Dunkirk.
Mm-hmm. Which is my favorite of his films.
Right. And that's the one where he strips back. I mean, people always had this issue with exposition with him, right? That one has like no exposition, pretty much. There's almost no dialogue. And he's got this very convoluted sort of setup where you have multiple stories happening at different lengths of time.
It takes place on air, land, and sea, and every environment is being played out at its own time frame.
Yes.
So some is an hour, some is a day, and some is a week or something.
I've seen that movie a few times now, and I've sort of followed how he did that. And it's actually incredibly precise the way that he's constructed it. But what's amazing is you could watch the movie and not pick up on the fact that it's doing that, and it would not matter at all to your enjoyment of the movie.
Yes.
Just wouldn't matter at all. Now, maybe if you're thinking about it too much and you start to get lost and then you're not into what's happening, I can see sort of the movie leaving you cold in that way. But what's important is what's happening on the screen and getting you from moment to moment. He does that to like a crazy level in Tenet, which I think is a movie that I joked to you. I saw it in the theater and I thought I had a pretty decent grasp on it. Like I didn't understand half of it, but I was like, I got, you know, why people were doing what at various moments. It sort of seemed to make sense. I watched it again, last week. Now, granted, I was high on an edible, so that might have, you know, skewed things, but I actually think I understood it less than I did the first time. Like there was stuff that I was like, I thought I understood. And now I was like, I actually don't understand why he's driving there and handing the thing to that guy. And yet I enjoyed it more because the ability to just let go and enjoy it almost as like, here's Nolan presenting you the bones of what are recognizable as sort of a James Bond-y type movie, plus these crazy action sequences. That's all you need in the movie, basically. It seems to be that that's kind of his intent. Is like, and this gets us to the sound mixing in the movie, which I think people have made more of than it is. I think it's more comprehensible than people say. But it is often very hard to hear the dialogue. And I don't think Nolan actually cares all that much. I don't think it's that important to him. I think he's like, if you can hear the dialogue, great. But the dialogue isn't the point, even when it's exposition. He's like, you know what? You don't need to know the exposition. Because as long as you know the tropes of this movie, just follow it along. And you're going to see some unexpected things because it goes in some weird directions with time, literally. It's a very strange evolution that he's had in that sense.
So I saw Interstellar when I was on vacation in Salta in northern Argentina. So I didn't get to see it in 70mm or IMAX, but I did get to see it in Argentina with Spanish subtitles. And I enjoyed it. Some people hate Interstellar. I didn't. For the amount of time that I spent enjoying Interstellar, I was aware of how didactic Nolan is as a visual stylist and as an imaginative person, that he had McConaughey's character explaining what the Tesseract was while it was happening. Mm-hmm. And my joke mm-hmm. was that if Nolan had directed 2001... at the end, when the astronaut was in that stateroom, he'd be like, that's me, except now I'm a 75-year-old man, you know, to make sure that nobody in the audience, like, he feels that he has to stop and explain to you what he's doing all the time. Inception has a great deal of that as well, like, you know, explain what all the levels are of all the dreams. Like, it's a very literal-minded way of approaching dream logic that just suggests to me a really sort of suppressed personality.
I mean, have you seen how he dresses?
Well, yes. And I've seen how he dresses his actors who are playing him, like DiCaprio in Inception and Pattinson in Tenet, are dressed like Christopher Nolan. My sort of beef against Nolan started to lift when I saw Dunkirk, which you explained the structure. But what I really liked about Dunkirk was that he was just being a formal expressionist without telling you what he was doing, letting you figure it out, not caring whether or not you do figure it out, letting you absorb the movie as it's happening. I started to become aware while watching the movie of the three timelines and moving in on each other, the way that the needle gets closer and closer to the middle of the record when the record's almost over. But he didn't explain what he was doing. He didn't have a character come on and tell you what was happening. He just presented it that way. And I thought, good for you, Christopher Nolan. Like, you're a filmmaker now in many ways. Like, you're telling a story and you're putting it all up on the screen, but you're also not stopping to make sure I get it, which I really appreciated. And to me, that was what really won me over with Tenet. Yeah. I might have been really disappointed by it if I had seen it in a movie theater, also being worried that I might catch the coronavirus at the screening and being all nervous about the environment and also all the expectations that this movie was going to save cinema. It would have been a huge letdown. Mm-hmm. But like you, I took an edible and I fired up Tenet on my laptop over the Christmas holidays. I watched about a half an hour of it and I got bored. And I thought it was visually very interesting, but I was getting confused by the fact that I didn't know what was going on, nor did I care. So I bailed. And then the next day, I took another edible. And the next day, I took another edible, and I continued on. And then I started enjoying the fact that it didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
To penalize a movie like Tenet for not making any sense is almost like penalizing a James Bond movie for not making any sense. Like, there's no point in getting hung up on the plot particulars of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. It's the vibe that he's trying to do and the feeling that is in your head when you think back on Bond movies that you've seen. He was doing that in real time and letting making sure that the movie just has to make sense while you're watching it.
Yes. Yeah, it's an interesting, I mean, he pushes it to the edge and it's very, I don't begrudge someone who watches Tenet and is like, I couldn't follow it. And it just, I couldn't deal with it. It makes perfect sense to me. That's not, you know, that's definitely a feature of the movie. But like, I think I told you earlier, before seeing Tenet, because of No Time to Die coming out, I had been rewatching all the James Bond movies. And one of the funny things in that is like, when the movies aren't like boring on a plot level, the plots actually just don't make any sense. Like, why is he going to this country, or why is he meeting with this, or like it, none of it ever makes any sense. What's important is getting you from moment to moment. And I think in Tenet, the important thing is like, okay, so you get the important scene of exposition where he learns that there are things and people who can go backwards, sort of through time, reverse entropy or whatever they call it.
Inversion.
Inversion. And that's about all you need to know, because, you know, so there's a lot of the exposition that people complained about not being able to hear is really just the exposition about like what is this mission that we're on this time? And it's like, who cares? We're seeing some people rappel up a building. It's fun. Like, it doesn't matter why they're there. They're going to get some piece of information and they're going to go to the next place, right? Notably, the other than that conversation with Clément's Poésie about inversion, you know, where he shoots the bullet, there's not a whole lot of other exposition explaining the mechanics. There's a little bit about the temporal pincer movement, but even that's so complicated that it's like when you're watching it, you can't understand it. There's a really hilarious moment where Robert Pattinson starts explaining like quantum physics to Elizabeth Debicki's character, and the scene just cuts away. Which feels like it feels like a joke about how you really don't need to understand.
It's like a Godardian joke.
Oh, totally.
It's like a Godardian joke where you have the placeholder scene where the plot mechanics are explained, but then you cut out before it's over. The way that Godard would just kill the music in the background of a scene.
In fact, I was watching the special features yesterday. There's sort of an hour-long documentary about the making of the movie on the Blu-ray. And I recommend anybody watch it because there's some good behind-the-scenes footage. They show how they film things backwards and everything. But there's a section where you've got a bunch of people involved with the movie talking just openly about how they didn't understand half of what they were doing, or like 90% of what they were doing. There's one guy who's talking about how, you know, they would come into a scene thinking that they understood the mechanics of what they were shooting. And then they would realize like, oh, wait a second. No, we're wrong about that. And then they would stand around for like an hour just arguing about what the correct mechanics of the sequence are. And even Nolan himself seems to have fallen into that. Like even he was sort of like, I couldn't always understand what I was doing. Right. But again, not important. It's just not important. It's a really fascinating, it's like the more I think about that movie, the more I'm like, it's just absolutely fascinating that it even got made. And it's also fascinating that it was positioned as the movie that was going to save cinema, because it's way too eccentric for that.
But at the same time, like, I'm so glad that I didn't see it under the context of the idea that it was going to save cinema. And I'm also glad that I didn't see it when I had sort of a lingering resentment of Nolan, which we're going to talk about in a second. Mm-hmm. I had this resentment that there's this pandemic going on. The world is in big trouble. We can't go to the movies right now because the world is in big trouble. And Nolan and Warner Brothers are like, we're opening Tenet in July. And then July comes around and they're like, we're opening it in August. And then
2 weeks later,
we're going to open it in Europe in August and in the US in September. And I, you know, I sort of wanted to watch the movie, but I was also mad at him a little bit because it seemed like he was playing a dangerous game in terms of prioritizing a movie release over the health and welfare of the population. And there were a lot of people out there, you know, Nolan's conservative fans, the Ben Shapiro types, who were like, put the movie out, put the movie out. I want to see Tenet.
Right.
When I watched Tenet over the Christmas holidays, it was now that I had a new idea about the way that Tenet was handled by Warner Brothers. I'd like you to expand on that because you also got my brain thinking this way.
Right. Well, I mean, so the story was, as it originally played out in the press, was Nolan is insisting on giving it a theatrical release. He wants to be the person who brings back movie theaters. You know, it's all on him. Now, I think that's probably partly true. I think he did kind of want to be the person who was like, now theaters are reopening with my movie. I think that certainly was probably part of his thinking because of the importance that he places on the theatrical experience as a matter of his artistic intent. Right.
And that weight is on his shoulders too. You know, it's been put on his shoulders by the fact that he's one of the few filmmakers who still shoots on film.
He shoots on film. He's also one of the few directors delivering big blockbuster entertainments that are original. So, you know, I think that there was a lot riding for him on that. I think that there was also, you know, it's funny how fast things have moved, but it's easy to forget that at that time, there was a little, especially during the summer, there was a little bit of a sense of like, actually, you know, maybe we can, deal with this, especially before, or at least before a second wave hits. Like, maybe we can sort of do things safely. There were a lot of countries where, you know, theaters opened and it wasn't a problem, actually. You know, there's countries where they're still open and it's not a problem. China's movie theaters are doing great. Japan just has, like, some record-breaking anime movie out in theaters. So it's, I think that there was probably some naivete about, you know, that Nolan had about, like, well, the United States can surely handle the coronavirus pandemic. But I think that there was an extra layer of this, which is that, and it has to do with timing, and it has to do with the fact that Warner Brothers needed to release the movie. And we're probably pressuring Nolan and saying, we need to release this movie. And he was like, well, you're not releasing it without giving it a theatrical release. And so they finally, you know, they sort of relented and said, like, okay, so we'll release it now. I think if Warner Brothers had told him, like, look, we just can't do it now, you know, we'll release this movie next year, he probably would have been fine with that. It would have gotten him it would have gotten him an even bigger theatrical release. But I get the feeling that that wasn't an option. And I've gotten that sense in part because of how they've since treated Wonder Woman, which they didn't need. They could have also pushed that back a year. Why not? Right.
Or put it out on video. Not to interrupt, but it's also important to note that Tenet didn't have a VOD release. It had an exclusive theatrical, which I think a lot of people put the blame on Nolan for that, because Nolan's Mr. Movie Theaters. I absolutely would have watched Tenet if it had been for $30 on video on demand in September, but it was only released theatrically and I did not want to play around.
I look, that part of it is clearly, you know, on him, right? But that has to do with his own, you know, he wrote like an open letter about the importance of protecting movie theaters, and he was calling on governments to subsidize movie theaters rents and that kind of thing. So I think he had some sense. Now, don't forget, the movie did make like something like almost $400 million, I think, in the middle of a pandemic. So there were clearly places in the world where people were going to see it. And I think that he's a lot less precious about the things that people think that he's precious about. I think, you know, he's talked about, like, look, you know, I watch Netflix, my kids watch Netflix, we watch things on our computers, we do all kinds of stuff. It's just that I make movies for the movie theater. So I want that to be the original presentation. And even if it's only so that, you know, when somebody who didn't see it in the theater watches it at home, they have something in their head that's like, well, but this was a movie that played in a big theater. And you try to imagine what it would have been, as opposed to like watching something that's direct to Netflix that just feels like TV, right? And, but then, so Wonder Woman was the next movie that was supposed to come out. And what I saw happening with that and the way that Warner Brothers kept pushing that back, partly due to the failure of Tenet at the domestic box office, it was very clear to me that they were in a position where they couldn't wait. They had sort of financial constraints that meant that, like, we have to release these movies. And so, you know, with Wonder Woman, they chose to release it day and date on streaming and VOD and in theaters. Funny enough, it made more money opening weekend in theaters in the States than Tenet did. And that tells me that the bigger issue with how Tenet was released was that to Warner Brothers, the movie was kind of expendable. They could position Nolan as like, he's the theatrical guy, he'll take the fall for this, and we'll use that as our proof that what we should be doing is releasing movies straight to streaming, which to them, of course, really has more to do with propping up their HBO Max streaming service than it does, you know, any care towards movies or movie theaters or anything like that. And I think that that's really what was going on. And I think that when Warner Brothers pulled the move a few weeks ago of announcing that their entire 2021 slate was going to go day and date HBO Max and theatrical, and Nolan had some choice words about that, I got the sense that he had felt burned by the way that because at this point, Tenet was already out. So he's not affected by that 2021 stuff, right? So why is he commenting? And I think that it's because he felt burned by the way that Warner Brothers treated him. That the way they treated the movie, the way they were sort of happy to, you know, kind of put out in the press that they were just doing what he wanted. And I'm like, I'm sorry, you know, for however powerful any director is, they're not powerful enough to like decide things for AT&T, right? It's just not, that's not how the world works.
It was funny when I watched The Dark Knight Rises again, I had a little metaphor idea where in the third act of The Dark Knight Rises, we discover that the Marion Cotillard character is the villain.
Yes.
And I was thinking that it was almost like Nolan was the whipping boy with Tenet, that Warner Brothers let him take most of the heat, that it's only going to be released theatrically. And it seemed like it was all Nolan's idea and Warner Brothers was just doing what the artist wants because we're such a great film studio and we care so much about the art.
Yeah.
But then it turns out in the 11th hour that Warner Brothers kind of let Tenet die. Now they had the excuse to say, well, you know, the theatrical market is fading away. It's time to put everything on HBO Max and give it a sort of limited theatrical run, which is going to be the kiss of death because most people are just going to stay home and save money by watching movies on HBO Max and they have a month to do it. I guess it's an exclusive window of only a month. Then it'll wind up back on HBO Max later.
Yeah, I think the idea is it'll have a month and then it'll be VOD or something. Yeah, they have some system.
But it turns out that Warner Brothers is Miranda Tate in The Dark Knight Rises, that all of a sudden they stabbed Christopher Nolan, aka Batman. You discover that Warner Brothers is the villain here. It's not Nolan, it's Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers is giving some speech about the knife that cuts slowest or something, some nonsense. Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
can we also talk brief? Can we just say that Marion Cotillard's death scene in The Dark Knight Rises is some of the worst acting I've ever seen?
It's one of those moments that's, you know, you've seen the animated GIFs of it. It's like, I don't understand what she was thinking she was doing. I also don't understand, did they not do enough takes? Was this the best take? And then the other part of it is like, I don't, you know what? At some point, maybe if it is the only take, just kind of cut away from it in such a way, look at the other characters reacting to her dying or something. It's one of those things that Nolan does where I'm like, almost every movie of his has something like that where I'm like, you could have just cut this bit. Like in Tenet, the thing that everyone makes fun of is, including my son.
I had a viral tweet with this one.
Well, you can explain it.
There's a scene where Pattinson's saying, if the bad guys get their plan, then everything and everyone in this world will die. And then Elizabeth Debicki?
I don't know.
Anyway, so Elizabeth Debicki says, including my son. And I was like, what? So everything's going to die, including my son.
I was
like, you could have cut that line of dialogue out.
I was shocked, actually, that after all of the jokes that Nolan didn't like subtly go in and edit it out of the Blu-ray, like, because it's totally unnecessary. Totally unnecessary.
Well, somebody, when they were lecturing me for making fun of that, was like, well, that's obviously a sign that Debicki's son is Robert Pattinson. And I was like, well, Nolan makes sure that you understand everything that he's trying to get at. So since there's no scene where that is explained,
yeah,
remove that line because it makes everyone laugh.
It's very silly. I mean, speaking of things that make us laugh, like he's not as good of a villain as Bane by any stretch, but whatever the hell Kenneth Branagh is doing in the movie had me so delighted. There's one scene where he's like giving Elizabeth Debicki a talking to, and he's talking about being a tiger or something. And, and you know, this is a movie, I think that scene is shot on 70 millimeter. So it's like in widescreen, but it's still, you know, super sharp 70 millimeter photography. And his face just keeps getting closer and closer and closer to the camera as he gets more and more vitriolic. And I remember seeing it in IMAX and just the immensity, the enormity of his face on the screen was incredible, just absolutely incredible. And it felt, and that was one of those things where I'm like, 100% Nolan has a sense of humor about this. He knows that he's doing a Bond villain. He's told Kenneth Branagh to just go for it, and he's going for it, giving it his all.
And I'll just say that, like, you know, I've never really liked Kenneth Branagh, and he has one of the wobbliest IMDb filmographies as a director you can find.
Yes, Artemis Fowl.
All these Shakespeare adaptations, and then Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit. You know, it's like wobbly city. But when Branagh first appeared, it was when he did Henry V, the big critically acclaimed Shakespeare. And it seemed that Branagh was our new modern interpreter of William Shakespeare. Our new Laurence Olivier.
Yes,
was how they described him.
Also a ham. I mean,
well, this is what I'm getting at, is that that Olivier became a huge ham, and I was kind of happy that Branagh is being so faithful to be the new Olivier, that as he enters into his late 50s or so, that he's hamming it up the way that Olivier did in Marathon Man and in The Boys from Brazil.
Yeah,
like just serving up big thick slices of hammy acting. Like, so I and I'll say again that I don't really like Branagh very much as a screen presence either. His lips are too thin. That's my big beef with Kenneth Branagh. Oh, he has no lips.
Yes, yes. But one of my friends is on about that all the time, about his thin lips.
Like, you can't have a movie star with no lips, as far as I'm concerned. This is now two straight movies where I've liked Kenneth Branagh that were directed by Christopher Nolan, because I thought he was very good in Dunkirk. And though some people were complaining about his performance in Tenet, I was into it. It was a little too mean. Like, there was a very sadistic scene towards the Elizabeth Debicki character in terms of sexual threats and violence that I was uncomfortable with watching the movie, partly because it was gross, but also partly because Nolan is so squeamish about depicting any kind of sexuality.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was weird that he's more inclined to dramatize a woman being sadistically treated by a man, as opposed to a love scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird thing with him, because his movies are like the opposite of sexy. You know, if there's any like serious critique I have of him, it's that his movies have no sex, and no sexiness about them. And in this one, which is supposed to be a Bond movie, there's no real Bond girl in the sort of sensual manner.
Or chemistry between the male and the female lead.
Or chemistry. And yet, there is still the bad treatment of the female character from a Bond movie by the villain, you know, which is very, very common. And I don't know what his hang-up is about, like, sensuousness.
He might think girls have the cooties. I wouldn't rule that out.
You know, it's, I also just think that it's a problem generally in movies today. Like, the movies today are frequently not sexy at all. Mainstream movies, it's a very weird thing. It's sort of like a, you know, result. It's probably a result of like Spielberg and Lucas kind of taking over the industry. But it's definitely an issue in this movie that, you know, the sadistic violence on its own is like fairly typical, you know, okay, we're going to establish that this guy is genuinely a horrible monster, but it just feels a little like overdone. I did learn that, you know, there's a scene, I don't know if it's a scene you're referring to, but there's a scene where he is kicking her on the ground.
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, and interestingly, in the UK, that scene netted the movie too high of a rating. And so in the UK, and only in the UK, there's a slightly different cut of the movie to get it down to like a 12 rating, where they've sort of trimmed like one or two of the kicks. So it's just less mean. And I can actually see that being like an improvement in a way to the movie.
It was an ugly note for the movie to play, I thought. Like, I didn't really need to see that to dislike this character.
Yeah.
But I was aware of the fact that, like, even earlier on, like, when the protagonist is being told about the girl, he says something along the lines of using his charms to seduce her or something, and then that's the end of that. Like, there's no chemistry between them at all. He doesn't seem to be interested in her. But then Brana, you know, kicks her in the stomach.
What's funny, actually, is that I had remembered that scene that way, and then when I rewatched it, I realized that Michael Caine saying that he should seduce Elizabeth Debicki, or he implies
that he'll have to use his charms to seduce
and
her.
John David Washington is like, you know, I don't know what charms you think I have, basically. So he's sort of implying that he doesn't have the ability to seduce a woman, and then Michael Caine is like, oh no, not sexually, we actually have this like blackmail thing over her.
I missed that part because I was on edibles.
I missed it the first time I saw it, and the second time I was like, oh, I get it. But what's interesting is I saw somebody on Twitter sharing an interview with Nolan where he talks about how originally the intent was for there to be more chemistry between the two of them, but it somehow wasn't really working that way just because of the way that it's written. Instead, all the chemistry is between John David Washington and Robert Pattinson, and then to some extent, Aaron Taylor Johnson, which, you know, then you get that sort of Leone-esque scene at the end with the three of them saying goodbye. And I don't know that I would call it emotional exactly, but there definitely is like a feeling in that scene of like, oh no, the bros, they're separating.
Well, you know, I've been filtering a lot of my thinking about movies in the last couple of years to the whole concept of dudes rock.
Right.
And Tenet is absolutely a dudes rock movie. There's not enough Pattinson in the film. He makes up for it in the second half, but he's not in it so much in the first half. But I was getting some major dudes rock vibes from their scenes together. And then at the end with Aaron Taylor Johnson rolling in too.
Yes.
That the real sort of love story and bonding is going on is between the dudes. And I thought it was funny for Christopher Nolan to be getting in on the dudes rock movement.
I mean, he does seem to have a bit of a sense of like, okay, that's where cinema is right now. It's, you know, we're in the world of dudes rock. They rock out together. It's the once upon a time in Hollywood thing of like, we're just going to sit around and watch FBI. This is like the ideal situation for dudes.
We're going to play Call of Duty for real. And some of us are going to be playing it backwards. Dudes rock thinking. That's like getting wasted with your pals.
I have no idea what's happening during that climactic battle of that movie, but it does feel like a Call of Duty sequence, just all jumbled up. It's great. They're great. You know, you're playing multiplayer Call of Duty. It's fantastic. And also I should mention Aaron Taylor Johnson, who like, I don't know that I've ever liked him in anything.
No, me neither.
And when he showed up,
he was so good.
I had no idea that he was going to be in the movie. He shows up like halfway in, just walks in full. It's like full military gear. He walks into that room with like a team of soldiers and you're just like, what's all this? And I saw somebody on Twitter make a joke about how it's great how he just shows up in the middle of the movie going like, oi, what's up, governor? And like starts giving them instructions on how to do temporal pincer movements.
It's like getting wasted in a bar and having to hear this guy's fucking theory, like some like bloke trying to like impress you with his mind. I was really into it.
It's great. It's great. He has a great look in it with that beard. It's like a whole situation. I mean, it's, and there's no character there. I don't know why I like him.
No, there's no character at all, but he's a type. And at this point, I'll take a type over a badly drawn character.
Yeah, precisely. Precisely. I mean, even that's something that actually, you know, going back to Bane, that I think is quite impressive about Bane is that I don't think that Bane is a type, because if he's a type, I have no idea what type Bane is. I can't recall any villain quite like him where in fact, I think often when you get a villain like that, who's so, sort of seems to be a parody of something, it's unfortunately usually sort of a kind of a queer-coded character. And you know, that's a complicated thing. I mean, often those performances are very fun, but, you know, it's a bit queasy. I recently watched for the first time The Silent Partner. That has a bit of that going on, and it's a bit, you know, it's a bit weird. Whereas in this, it doesn't have that at all. It just has, like, again, it's that sexless, that sexless Nolan thing. In fact, there's a whole section in there where you learn in the sort of Talia al Ghul backstory, where you find out that she was the child in the pit.
And Bane was her rescuer.
Bane was her rescuer. And it's implied almost that they have some kind of a romantic, or that he has some romantic feelings, except that she was like 11 or 12. And yet it's not queasy at all when you're watching it, because there's no sex. I mean, even though there's, I guess, Batman does have sex with Marion Cotillard's character in the movie, in theory, the movie is so sexless that it wouldn't even occur to you to think that there's something wrong with that Bane relationship. It's like, oh, he's her protector. Okay, fine. I get it. He loves her because, you know, I don't know. It's a Christopher Nolan movie. Like,
I thought it was very funny how she put him in the friend zone at the end when she's like, goodbye, old friend. Bane's obviously madly in love with her.
Yes. And clearly he takes it out. He takes it out on Batman, decides and to then, try and kill him anyway.
And the one thing that we can say about Bane being like the best movie villain in a long, long time, like I think like it goes all the way back. I was thinking, who's another villain that had that much good dialogue in the movie? And I have to go all the way back to Hopkins in The Silence of the Lambs in terms of, and he was only on screen for 20 minutes, but he had so many memorable lines of dialogue.
But that's a similar situation. I mean, Bane, I think, probably has more screen time. Probably.
Yeah, he's in the movie for maybe 45 minutes, an hour.
Yeah, he probably has more screen time. But when you actually break down, he doesn't have that many lines. Like, he doesn't have that much dialogue. There's like three sort of speeches. And then the rest is like here and there, like, you know, three or four lines to a character. And yet almost every line is memorable. And that's the same thing with Hopkins, where it's like he's not in the movie that much. And you remember him so well. And you remember everything that comes out of his mouth. It also gives the movie a similar vibe to that Hopkins performance, where when I'm watching Dark Knight Rises and Bane shows up, I'm like, oh yes, baby, play the hits. Just say those lines. I want to hear them. It adds to the enjoyment of it. There's something, you know, it's comic booky, right? It's like, yeah, you know, it's like, I'm not in this for the psychological depth. I just really want to hear Bane, you know, say like, I was wondering what would break first, your spirit or your body. You know, it's like, I want to hear that stuff.
You, what does he say? You only adopted the dark. I was molded by it or whatever.
It's like so funny. And I was probably one of the few people in the theater who was just laughing away at Bane. Like, I was so relieved, because one of the things that bugged me about, especially about The Dark Knight, was the ethics 101 kind of moral dilemmas being presented to you. And the fact that The Dark Knight Rises was missing all that and just pulp, which is what Batman should be.
Yeah, I mean, there is another line in the movie that is not a Bane line, but in fact, it may be dumber than any of Bane's lines. And it's when Joseph Gordon-Levitt says, this bomb is a time bomb. And to me, that...
I didn't notice that. Yeah.
It encapsulates the whole movie. It's, this bomb is a time bomb. It encapsulates Tenet as well. I remember seeing somebody going like, I don't understand. They were trying to piece together this thing. What was going on? I'm like, doesn't matter. There's a doohickey bomb thing that's going to destroy the world. That's all you need. Like, the bomb is a time bomb.
Now, Corey, let's talk a little bit more about edibles. What I was thinking was that we're now in this world where weed is being decriminalized and legalized, and we have access to it now. And one of the things that I was thinking about with Tenet is, are movies now being made for stoners, like legalized stoner behavior? Like, the fact that Tenet has stoner logic, and that you are probably best appreciating this movie if you're a little bit stoned. I was wondering, because Nolan's always been this formal, you know, logistic sort of guy wanting all the pieces to work together. And Tenet doesn't really work that way, but it's so much better for it. And I was wondering if it's because movies are, this is just a little, you know, blue skying that I'm doing here. Are we now in a world where we're going to get movies made, dudes rock sort of action movies for people who like to get high and watch dumb action movies that are sort of smart, but not actually all that smart? I don't know. Why do I like Nolan more now?
I like that theory. I mean, I'll say that for my part, you know, I occasionally smoked here and there over the years, but it's only since like quarantine started that I've like been doing it more regularly. Got myself a vape pen, got like, you know, there is something to that. There's something to that because I don't know that Nolan has ever touched a drug in his life. He doesn't look like the type. But then again, I could imagine him being the guy who in college, you know, did a little bit and was like, you know, it would be amazing, a movie, but backwards. Right. And it's taken him until sort of Dunkirk and Tenet to realize how to do that in the most effective, like, just forget everything, get high and don't worry way. There's definitely,
don't try to understand it. Just smoke this weed and then watch the movie. Just totally. Feel it.
Totally. So,
but yeah, I was just thinking, like, why am I, is it because I just feel much more charitable about Nolan, and it's changed in the last couple of months. It changed for me when he shit all over HBO Max and complained about Warner Brothers, rightly so.
What was the line that he used that he said, you had a bunch of filmmakers who thought they were working for the best film studio, and it turns out they were working for the worst streaming service.
But good for
him. Which is an incredible line.
Good for him. You know, like, so he was starting to win me over because somebody has to say it, I feel.
Yes.
And for also for him in the position, like, he's actually now using the power that he has against his corporate masters, who, as it turns out, Warner Brothers is.
Well, he was talking about, I mean, he gave an interview after that statement where he was talking about, you know, this isn't about him and it's not even about the big filmmakers. It's about, like, what about the unions who count on royalties to fund their pensions and all of these things. You know, you're talking about people who have an investment in the movie. And I think there's something, you know, I don't know that we can make Christopher Nolan into like some, you know, labor hero or something, but I think that there is something to the idea that he is sort of a working director. He's a guy who comes to set and, you know, for all that people compare him sometimes to like Kubrick in terms of his like precision of these storylines, he's actually not a very precise filmmaker. He doesn't do that many takes. I listened to an interview with his DP, Hoyte van Hoytema, who's an amazing DP. And he was saying, like, you know, there'll be a scene where like, oh, it got cloudy all of a sudden and the continuity's off. Nolan's like, you know what? Fine, whatever. It doesn't really matter. People will follow it. Who cares? And I think that comes from that impulse of like, I'm a working filmmaker. What does it mean to be a working filmmaker? It means I make movies. I work with a crew. They come out in theaters. You know, there is something about that I think resonates with him. And frankly, it resonates with me. And it's the reason why for all these years when people have sort of made jokes about like, well, I'm watching, you know, Interstellar on my iPhone or on my Apple Watch as, as Christopher Nolan intended. You know, I don't think that Nolan is the type of person who's like, just because I intended it to be seen in IMAX, the only way that one can watch it is IMAX. He just means I intended it to be seen in IMAX. The same way that, like, you know, I might record music and I intend for it to be heard on a good hi-fi system, but I understand that most people are going to hear it on the radio and it's going to sound like crap, right? Mm. There's something honest about that to me, as opposed to, like, you know, some of these Marvel directors who come from the indie world who, you know, should know better. And instead they're making excuses about how, well, actually we're making the Parallax view, but with Captain America. And it's like, well,
there's a 3 second shot of a reel to reel tape recorder in the Winter Soldier. So people are like, just like All the President's Men in the Parallax View.
Right. Right.
Like, and for instance, no Marvel director would dare to have their villain
talk like this, where you can't hear anything they're saying.
Yes.
But Nolan does it.
Yeah.
And good for him. I'm starting to really admire that now.
I don't think it always works. Like, again, I think I like his movies more than you, but even beside that, I recognize a lot of the issues in his movies, but there's something just honest about the fact that he's making the movies that he wants to make his way. Even his Batman movies, it's funny whenever I talk about them, because I think of them like their original material, not like their IP. Right? Mm-hmm. Because there's something about the way that they're made that feels uniquely, not just uniquely him, but uniquely of an artist, right? Which is very different from like when, you know, I don't know, James Gunn makes Guardians of the Galaxy and people are like, oh, wow, it's got jokes and it's kooky. So I guess it's like, you know, like one of his trauma
movies. It's got a personality.
I'm like, yeah, I mean, a little bit, but they're basically just Whedon-esque kind of jokes. That's not, to me, the definition of an artistic sensibility. He doesn't overwhelm his corporate overlords the way that Nolan clearly does. You know, for whatever you think of the movies themselves, I think that that's something that really shouldn't be discounted, because there's very, very few filmmakers working at that level who even try to do that, let alone succeed.
I read just before we recorded, I read a tweet that made me smile. It was somebody who said, I will take Robert Pattinson yammering on about temporal pincers or whatever meaningless jargon over they fly now, kind of Whedon kind of shit.
Totally.
Like we need idiosyncratic material that's not brought to you by a major corporation in a sort of like Pavlovian response, like you expect to have the well that happened kind of dialogue,
yeah,
where you're given permission to laugh or whatever. You know, Nolan wants to give you permission to die. What I mean is that Nolan wants to like waste your time with jargon that you can either take seriously or not take seriously, but there's more character and personality to that in the long run than received ideas being given to you once again the way you expect to receive them.
Right. Even if outside of Bane, there's not much character in terms of characters, right? It's like there's something going on in the filmmaking impulses it's not just that it's, you know, auteurist. That's clearly the case, but it's just that that somebody is sort of taking the keys and running with them. And it makes it really funny to me that, you know, when Tenet didn't make as much money as they hoped at the domestic box office, it's partly because there's a pandemic and all of that, but also because it's an original movie. Yes, people know, okay, Christopher Nolan, or maybe they know director of Inception and The Dark Knight or something. But that's like a lot to throw at an audience in the middle of a pandemic to say, here's a movie that like you don't know anything about. And if you read the reviews, it's confusing as hell and you might not have a good time. and
you might not even be able to hear what people are saying.
And yet, worldwide, the movie still made like $400 million. So if there wasn't a pandemic, that movie might have gotten close to $1 billion, which is remarkable. Like, it's remarkable that he's been able to cultivate this sort of idea that, like, I'm going to make a big blockbuster movie. I'm going to do it with as many practical effects as possible. It's like being a showman, right? It's like he can then go out and promote the movie and say, I'm doing something different from what other people are doing, right? So you might want to go see Avengers Endgame because it, you know, is the continuation of this story that you've been watching. And so you have to go see it. Whereas I'm giving you something that you have to go see because you're going to see something you haven't seen before. You're going to experience something you haven't experienced before. I'm going to show you things that don't look like overcooked, you know, bad screensavers with, you know, terrible CGI. I'm gonna show you the truck flipping in The Dark Knight, and it's gonna be an actual truck. I'm gonna show you one plane pulling another plane out of the sky in The Dark Knight Rises. I'm gonna show you in Tenet a building exploding and unexploding at the same time.
And I'm going to show you a movie that is going to reflect the sort of nonlinear worlds that we live in. Like, we rewind things all the time when we're watching something. Totally. We rewind it. So, but we haven't really gone to a movie where the filmmaker is rewinding it for you, going back and forth and fucking around with time. If you watched Tenet backwards, there'd be all this stuff that would be happening to you forwards as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
It's just such an imaginative, but at the same time, it's playing with all these things that film can do. It's not supposed to be airtight logic. And I find that liberating, coming from such a control freak and such a literal-minded person as Nolan, for him to be letting that stuff go now.
There's also something to it in terms of the actual craft of the filmmaking. And this comes from partly watching the special features and partly listening to that interview with Van Hoytema. The fact that he shoots on film, and not only shoots on film, but processes on film and does all of that, that sort of creates physical barriers in what he's able to do, but also requires then inventing interesting solutions. So, for example, they talk about, they don't explain it in the documentary, but I think they explained it in the, Hoytema explained it in that interview, where they actually got IMAX to rejigger a couple of their cameras to run in reverse. Now, you would think, like, well, why do they need it to run in reverse? Because can't you just scan it in and then just reverse it, you know? But no, because they're processing everything on film, they can't do that. They don't have the ability to do that unless they want to do a DI and put it back out, and Nolan doesn't want to do that if he can help it. And so that's where you then get the idea of, like, oh, wow, what he did was, like, he filmed sequences where he had stunt people learn how to perform in reverse so that it looked like they're in reverse, but so that when the film is filmed backwards, it actually looks like they're going forwards. That's a crazy thing to do. And again, like, whether you enjoy the movie or not is almost beside the point. I appreciate, if you're going to make movies at that level, that you do it with a sense of pizzazz, right? And yeah, maybe the movies look cold or whatever, but that's where the pizzazz is. And it reminds me of, you know, Tarantino releasing his, you know, whether Hateful Eight was the one that was really on 70mm, like, he shot it on 70mm. And not only that, he used a format that, like, hadn't been used in 50 years and had to, like, get all these theaters to, like, install special lenses and stuff to project it. And, you know, you can say, like, Hateful Eight was good or bad, but that 70mm roadshow did really well because people were like, oh, I'm going to get to see something in a way that I ordinarily don't get to see it. It's not going to be like going to a theater and seeing a dimly lit, you know, digital projection. I'm going to get a film print brightly lit in a format that I don't normally see. It's showmanship. I mean, that's part of the art. It's an art that's built around, you know, it sort of grew up and out of vaudeville, right? The same sort of sensibility. The fact that Tenet might be, like, a stupider movie than it lets on is beside the point. You know, it's the entertainment value that's important, not the, like, how much it makes you think, right? If it does make you think, then fine, I guess that's cool. But, like, you know, I'm sure there's some teenage boys who really got, there's, like, 14-year-old me who, like, watched Tenet in reverse and was like, this is the most mind-blowing thing I've ever seen. By the way, I totally expect that when they reopen theaters, that Tenet will get a theatrical re-release. I completely expect that to happen. I imagine that Warner Brothers spent too much money on, like, 70mm prints of the movie not to release them. Like,
they're all ready to go. Theaters. They're ready to go.
Yeah.
And it's a movie that people will be like, that'll be a sign for a lot of people that the world is back to normal, because now they can go and see Tenet.
They can go see Tenet and not understand the dialogue the way that it was meant to be not understood.
see the movie that nobody rises. Understands. If you only don't understand one movie this year, make it Tenet. So, Corey, before I let you go, has there been anything that you've seen lately that has struck a chord with you? It's my favorite question to ask my guests.
Well, I'll set it up by saying that during the pandemic, I've found it, for the most part, fairly difficult to watch anything too serious, too, like, artfully engaging. It's just a bit tough. And so I've gravitated towards, you know, action movies and particularly, like, sort of older bad movies and direct-to-video and exploitation movies from the 70s and that sort of thing. And among those is I recently got in a copy of the Bloody Terror box set from Indicator, which is a Blu-ray label out of the UK. And they put out a set with, I think it's five or six films by the British filmmaker Norman J. Warren. I don't know if you're familiar with him. I was not familiar with him at all. I just got the set because it looked kind of cool and it had some exploitation horror movies. And so I was like, this sounds good. And these movies, I've watched two of them now, and they're so strange and so beautifully filmed and so exploitative. They're just fantastic. And these discs in particular are loaded with special features, interviews and commentaries and all kinds of stuff. And I've just been really, 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 really getting into those. So to anybody who, you know, wants to go down the exploitation movie route, the Norman J. Warren box set, Bloody Terror from Indicator series. I mean, to give you an idea, one of the movies is called Satan's Slave. So, you know, and then another one is called Inseminoid, which I'm very excited to get to. I have
actually heard of Inseminoid.
Well, yes. So there you go.
How could you forget a title like Inseminoid?
A lot of sex and nudity, a lot of like gore and violence. And again, just beautifully shot. It's just like stuff shot on film really, really nicely. Great restorations that they've done. Highly recommended.
So, Corey, thank you so much for coming on. You and I have been friends for many years, and we became friends on Twitter. And I think Bane was one of the grounding forces in our friendship because we were constantly making Bane jokes for a long, long time.
Yeah.
What I love about Bane jokes is that you can milk them forever. Like, they're still funny years later, and you can still make Bane jokes, even though it's been so long, because it's just an evergreen topic of humor for me.
Well, I mean, this is like even thinking about you doing a podcast and getting to hear your voice finally, instead of just seeing your funny tweets. What a lovely, lovely voice.
Thank you, Corey.
I just I love Bane. God bless Tom Hardy for doing what he did. Thank you, Christopher Nolan, for giving him to us.
I'm going to put in the show description a link for this very funny little behind-the-scenes video of Tenet that has John David Washington bragging about how he gets to throw the first inverted punch in the history of cinema. I burst out laughing. Where he was really excited about throwing the first backwards punch in the movie. There's all this incredible Nolan hagiography in this clip too. So I'm gonna include that in the show description. Corey, where can people find you on Twitter?
My name is Corey Attad, Coreyatad. People often get confused about how to spell my name. For some reason, it's not that hard, but they do. I'm just on Twitter too much, and that's about it.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, and please come back again. You're cordially invited.
And when Gotham is ashes, then you have my permission to die.
But only then.
Only then.
Corey Attad, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks.
That's the end of this episode, but I need to tell you something funny. I heard back from the screenwriter of Clint Eastwood's The 1517 to Paris. She really liked the episode, and she says she has some answers for some of the many questions that Matt Crisman and I had about the movie. So we're supposed to have a chat in the DMs about that, and if I hear anything incredible, I'll provide you listeners with an update. If you're enjoying the podcast, please like and subscribe to it, and please tell your friends. We do have a Patreon if you're interested in supporting this program directly. And the link to our Patreon is at our Twitter account, which is JunkFilterPod. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Happy 2021, and thank you for listening.